Hello, welcome to The Wire, where you can get independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station, wherever you are in Australia. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think what he's going to do is try and find a new Prime Minister who's able to actually forge together a political alliance.
French President Emmanuel Macron will be forced to renegotiate alliances with other parties after the President lost his majority in the National Assembly. Macron's centrist coalition, which wants to raise the retirement age and deepen EU integration, was set to win the most seats on Sunday but ended up way short. Also on the program...
If we summed up all of the bacteria and viruses and other microbes in the ocean... Their cumulative biomass makes up 95% of all the living biomass in the ocean. So,
with only 5% of our oceans charted, it seems there's still a lot we don't know about what is living in our oceans. Marine microbes are tiny organisms which are everywhere, and we're only just finding out how important they are to the health of this planet. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire. Labor's path to a workable Senate looks quite good as the results from the AEC have come in, and it shows that they would have a blocking majority with the Greens and they only would need one further senator to pass legislation. The news came in a difficult week for Mr. Albanese as he has been heavily questioned on whether he will push for the release of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Dr. Stuart Jackson is a senior lecturer in politics at the University of Sydney, and I asked him whether the Labor Party was in a lot better position now in the Senate than they thought they might be prior to the election.
What has happened is that two of the states, WA, Tasmania, and in fact Queensland, have elected a bit of a mix of candidates. So certainly in WA, the Labor Party was able to improve their position. And with the Greens, and this is the same thing has happened in certainly Tasmania, to the point where Labor, the Greens, and a member of Jackie Lambie's network, the two senators there, or Pocock, David Pocock from the ACT, will be able to pass legislation. Essentially, what the Greens and Labor together have is a blocking majority. They can block anything within the Senate. And they need one vote to be able to pass anything.
But, for instance, at the moment there is quite a lot of discussion on the energy policy and the potential for blackouts. And the Greens just say, well, you know, we just put more renewables in and this is going to be the answer and we should have done this earlier and, you know, get rid of all these coal-fired stations. But, of course, the ALP are saying, well, I don't think it's going to work. We need to keep some coal-fired stuff going for a bit longer. Is this going to cause a bit of a problem getting through the Senate?
Yes and no. What we've actually seen is some jockeying for position. Shane Rattenbury, the Greens Minister for Energy in the ACT, has said that coal-fired power may well be part of the mix going forward. Now, that puts that opens up the opportunity, certainly for Labor to start saying that, hey, you know, you're not even solid on this. Can we negotiate? I actually think that's what this is about. It's about negotiating the process for winding down coal-fired and gas-fired power generation and winding up renewables. And what's the rate going to be? Is it going to take 5 years or 10 years or whatever? And that, of course, will impact the new target just announced for emissions reduction by Albanese. So, you know, will it just be 43 or will we somehow be able to attain 50% or more?
Now, internationally, there is an imminent problem for Julian Assange, who looks like virtually no chance of anything stopping him being deported to the US, unless it's something that happens in the background between Australia and the UK or Australia and the US or everybody. And Anthony Albanese has been clear in saying that he wants Julian Assange released. He's suffered enough. What will the US do for Anthony Albanese at this stage, given he's only been in power for a couple of weeks?
I suspect not a great deal unless there is something on the table. So unless there is a reconfirmation of AUKUS, which I don't think will be an issue for Albanese, I think he'll be easily able to say, yes, We'll reconfirm to AUKUS. And by the way, let's also confirm some submarines as well. I think that's the sort of bargaining that might be happening behind the scenes. Yes, Biden and indeed the Democrats generally wants Australia on side and wants to be providing some support to them. What it might end up being is, you know, Assange can be transferred to Australia for jail in Australia, you know, or for trial in Australia or for some such. That would probably be the best outcome that Albanese could hope for, because the US is still very hot on getting Assange into the United States to try him for a variety of different charges and put him in jail forever.
And he's a fairly divisive figure, and there mightn't be that many, you know, that much support for Albanese in doing this.
No, but he is an Australian. Assange is an Australian being pressured overseas. So there may well be, you know, particularly as we've had Chelsea Manning pardoned, there may well be a case for saying Assange, although a divisive figure and a person who's set up a system for releasing this information, is not themselves the person who did the espionage, is not the person who stole the secrets from the US military. They're the publisher, or some would say a journalist, but they weren't doing the actual activity. Therefore, there was at least some cover to say, well, maybe he should be, you know, perhaps put in jail for a period of time for that action. But should he be tried as some devil incarnate who spied on the US? Well, he didn't do that. So I think there's a certain amount of cover for both. And Assange, as an Australian, you know, should be a worrying concern for people. If you do something and the US doesn't like it, that they can just extradite you automatically and your government allows that. It doesn't seem, that seems very, sorry, should I say, politically expedient. You would hope that they would do something about you as an Australian citizen.
Dr. Stuart Jackson, Senior Lecturer in Politics at the University of Sydney, speaking with me there. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to The Wire around Australia on the Community Radio Network. French President Emmanuel Macron has lost his majority in Parliament to a new leftist coalition and the far right led by Marine Le Pen. Macron had been comfortably re-elected for a second term just 8 weeks ago as president, making him the first president in two decades to win re-election. Peter McPhee is an Emeritus Professor and Honorary Professorial Fellow from the University of Melbourne, and Andrew Hellinger asked him how Macron lost this majority.
Well, 2 months ago, he won a very tightly contested presidential election against a candidate of the sort of hard left named Mélenchon and a candidate from the far right named Le Pen. And what's happened in the elections for the Parliament, for the National Assembly over the weekend, is that both the left and the right have taken away seats from his party. So, you know, he's lost control of the parliamentary majority.
Emmanuel Macron won the election a little while ago, but now he's threatened to lose the majority. What sort of obstacles is he going to face now in terms of, say, delivering on the agenda that he came up with at the election?
Oh, he's got really serious problems, because both the left and the right in the parliament are very opposed to what he's wanting to do. So he's going to have to try and form an alliance, I think, with some of the smaller conservative parties to try and get a majority in parliament. I think that the other option of trying to find some more left-wing people to support him isn't going to work. So I think he's going to have to try and build a sort of coalition with some of the smaller conservative parties if he's going to be able to get through the policies that he's wanting to change.
The far-right leader, Marine Le Pen's national rally, they've won a lot of seats in this election. And is this a sign that now the whole of the French country is sort of shifting towards these sort of far-right opinions and perspectives?
Oh, no, I don't think so, because the left-wing parties managed to form an electoral alliance, and they won many more seats than did the far-right. I mean, the left-wing coalition of, you know, socialists and ecologists won about 130 seats out of 570, and the far-right won about 85. So you know, in fact, the left did rather better than Le Pen. But certainly people are very concerned that Le Pen's far-right party won so many seats because, you know, her policies are very aggressive in terms of hostility towards immigrants, particularly from North Africa. And she's very negative about the European Union and sort of European solidarity.
In terms of Macron, does he still remain popular in that country? Because now it's, you know, it was still a pretty good success at election that he had a couple of months ago.
Oh, that's right. But, you know, he won the presidential election because the majority of French people really don't want Le Pen and an extreme right-wing president. But the big problem for Macron is that only about 30% of the French population or the French voters are in favour of him, and that among the rest there's a great deal of negative feeling, so that he's seen by most people in France as sort of they call him the president of the rich, that even though he's a very smart guy in all sorts of ways and very articulate, very well regarded outside France. Inside France, he's seen to very often be undermining what most French people value very highly, which is their, you know, French social welfare and pension system.
So could he face a leadership challenge? Is his spot as the leader of the country under threat now?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think what he's going to do is try and find a new prime minister who's able to actually forge together a political alliance, so he's got a majority in the parliament. But I think his position as president, no, there's no question of him being forced out of that.
How reliant is the European Union on France in general?
I think that the leadership of Macron has been really important during the crisis in Ukraine, because it was really quite exceptional that he was able to get the 27 member nations of the European Union to agree on sanctions. And it's a pretty fragile unity, but I think his powers of persuasion have been very important. So you can understand many people being very relieved that neither Mélenchon nor Le Pen is going to end up as prime minister, because they're much less likely to be critical of Russia.
And in terms of the relations with Australia, because the relations with, let's say, the former prime minister, Scott Morrison, were also strained, how is Australia travelling with the recent developments?
I think that Prime Minister Albanese is very shortly heading off to Europe and looking forward to meeting Macron, who has expressed his pleasure that Albanese has been elected as Prime Minister. And certainly after the damage that was done to the Australian-French relation over the submarines issue, I think both countries are looking forward to sort of rebuilding very strong diplomatic relations, which, of course, we've had for many years. I don't think this will really harm relations between France and Australia, and I think France certainly sees Australia as a key international ally.
Emeritus Professor and Honorary Professorial Fellow from the University of Melbourne, Peter McPhee, speaking there with Andrew Herlinger. We know a lot about fisheries, the Great Barrier Reef and the migrations of whales, but there's a lot more fish in the sea than we realise. Only 5% of our oceans are charted, and there is a lot of life that we virtually know nothing about. The vast majority of life in the oceans are microbial, from bacteria upwards, but there is a lot to explore. I asked Professor Justin Seymour from the University of Technology Sydney just what was going on in the tiny world of ocean microbes.
There's this tiny invisible world in the ocean, which is playing really important roles in ocean function, and you mentioned the whales. But if we summed up all of the bacteria and viruses and other microbes in the ocean, even though each one of them is tiny, their cumulative biomass makes up 95% of all the living biomass in the ocean. So while we see all these whales and sharks and big organisms, their total biomass in the ocean is nothing compared to all these microbes. So a typical teaspoon of seawater would contain about a million bacteria within it. And often when people think about bacteria, they think about them in a negative light, that they can make you sick. But most of the bacteria in the ocean are completely harmless to us, and in fact play really critical roles in the function of the ocean. They form all of the cycling of nutrients that supports the productivity of the food web, and many of them are key photosynthesizers. So they're the base of the ocean's food web, and without these microbes, we wouldn't see the other organisms in the ocean, like fishes and things like that.
So it's kind of the first step on the food chain ladder.
Yep.
We've heard about krill being food for whales down towards Antarctica. Where do they fit? Are they much, much bigger compared to these microbes?
Yeah, krill are gigantic compared to the microbes. So there's a couple of levels of the food web below the krill, between the bacteria and the krill. But it's the bacteria that basically are the very base. They take up the chemicals out of the water that other organisms can't assimilate, and they turn that into living biomass. And then they're eaten by some slightly larger microbes, and then you sort of have the food web develop from there. But yeah, the bacteria at the very base and the way that they cycle things like carbon not only have a big effect on what flows into the food web and how productive the food web is, it also has a big effect on the chemical cycles that can influence climate at global scales.
Yeah, because carbon is there's more carbon stored in the sea than there is on the land. Is that right?
That's exactly right, quite a bit more. And so there's huge fluxes of carbon that come in and out of the ocean into the atmosphere, and a lot of this is driven by biological processes. So some marine microbes are photosynthetic, so that often some of these either algae or cyanobacteria called the forests of the sea, they photosynthesize in the top part of the ocean and in doing so turn carbon dioxide into living biomass. And then that's transferred through the bacteria and other microbes into the food web.
It sounds like a good opportunity for carbon capture.
Well, people have talked about that and have done pretty massive experiments on it where they've fertilized certain parts of the ocean with the nutrients that they know limit these phytoplankton to try to stimulate blooms of them. And this has been shown that it can draw carbon dioxide down from the atmosphere. Problem is there's a lot of other feedback loops amongst the microbes, which can ultimately lead to that carbon being returned quite quickly to the atmosphere when it's eaten by bacteria and they respire, for instance.
But you've mainly been looking at, recently anyway, about the movement of marine microbes. What happens when they move around?
Yeah, so we look at the motility or the swimming behaviour of marine bacteria. And this is something that people look at when they're looking at bacteria that might be pathogens of animals and humans, looking at how they might migrate from one part of the body to another. But traditionally, marine scientists and oceanographers have thought out in the ocean where everything's being ostensibly mixed up by turbulence, that swimming around isn't going to make much difference. But it turns out that a lot of the bacteria that are floating around in seawater are able to swim around in their local environment quite effectively, and that they have this capacity to sense their food or the chemicals that they consume. And this is called chemotaxis, where they can swim towards chemicals that they find beneficial. And so that's one of the things that we look at, and it's how bacteria in the ocean might be able to localize around rich sources of nutrients. Something we're very interested in is how bacteria and algae associate with each other in the water column. And there's emerging evidence that many of these relationships might be akin to a symbiosis, where the bacteria and the algae both mutually benefit from the relationship. But for that to occur, the organisms need to be close to each other. And for the best way for that to happen is that the bacteria swim right up close to the algal cell. And that's sort of one of the main focuses of some of our research, how these bacteria are able to swim close to the algal cell, what kind of chemicals they use as cues to find their algal cell that they then receive food from.
Professor Justin Seymour from the University of Technology Sydney, who led research with ETH Zurich and the University of Queensland on microbial life around our coasts, supported by the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, and speaking with me there.
Hi, it's Costa here from Gardening Australia, and I absolutely love listening to The Wire.
In the last couple of days, we've seen actions taken by the Environmental Protection Agency of New South Wales upheld by the courts against Forest Corp, another New South Wales government entity. Forest Corp was found guilty of felling trees after the bushfires that should have been left in sensitive koala habitats, areas of the New South Wales mid-north coast. I asked Chris Gambian, CEO of the Nature Conservation Council, What damage is being done to koala habitat due to this logging?
Well, one of the problems we've got is that this has become so widespread. It's happening all over the state. There's heaps of examples where important ecosystems have been inappropriately logged by the Forestry Corporation after those terrible fires. So you might recall in 2019, 2020, when the fires happened, you know, the forest was still smouldering and the logging trucks were trying to work out how they could get back in there and start taking trees out. The problem with that is you can imagine just how much threat those ecosystems were already under. Think about koalas, for example, who, apart from the koalas who actually perished in the fires, the amount of their habitat trees that had been lost, the amount of their feed trees that had been lost, then you've got Forestry Corp going in there as being, you know, an additional threat to those species. So, you know, all over the state there are these examples and they just keep adding up. You know, a one-off would be bad enough, but we've now had quite a few of them and they all point to the same thing, which is that overwhelmingly Forestry Corp sees itself as a logging business. It sees itself as not the custodian of our state parks that have very, very important environmental assets. They're important recreation zones. They're important for all sorts of public purposes. They see themselves as a business that is pretty much just about extracting trees.
Forestry Corp say that they, due to mapping errors, they harvested five trees in one case and four trees in another case, and that's what they were pinged for. But you're saying it's a lot more trees than that.
Well, it's systematic, is what I'm saying, is that these are not one-offs. One-offs, you might say, oh, it was a mapping error. Or one-off, oh, there was a, you know, some problem that tree got inappropriately taken because, you know, an individual made a mistake, you know, except that those mistakes do happen from time to time. What we are talking about is systematic behaviour. So they got fined last week. They got fined this week. They've been fined previously. Like, it just keeps happening. And so our message to the state government is how much do they need to do before you step in and decide to do something about it? I think that Forestry Corp needs to take a good hard look at itself and say, what is the business that we're in? They're entrusted with 2 million hectares of New South Wales bush, of which they harvest about 18,000 hectares a year. If their only concern is the harvesting they do and the money they can make from the harvesting, which doesn't really make very much money in itself, you know, that in itself is not a particularly viable business. And they disregard their role as environmental managers, as custodians of those parks, then I think we've got a problem. And the state government really needs to step in and do something about it.
So if they're fining the company every time that there is an incident, what more do you want them to do?
The EPA shouldn't have to fine them. You know, like, let's be clear on what we're talking about here. We're talking about one branch of the New South Wales state government needing to take enforcement action against another branch of the New South Wales state government. Now, that's environmental management and forestry management. Imagine if it was something else. Imagine if the New South Wales police force needed to prosecute some other government department in New South Wales. We would all be absolutely horrified. But what we have here is not one, not two, but five instances where the New South Wales Forestry Corp has been fined by the Environmental Protection Agency, both arms of the New South Wales government.
Because it's the government fining the government, one department.
It's the government fining the government. Mm. That's exactly right. And, you know, there should be a strong enough working relationship between those agencies. There should be enough protocol in place that these mistakes aren't consistently happening. The EPA, you know, it should be the easiest thing the EPA does, which is monitor forestry operations, but it's not. It's incredibly difficult for them, and it just shouldn't be. It should be a no-brainer that when you're entrusting a state government department to look after the state forests or state parks, that they're in fact being looked after.
Chris Gambian, CEO of the Nature Conservation Council, speaking with me there. And that's it for The Wire today. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.